Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And tonight we are going to take you for a
interview.
Yeah.
And, well, we have an interview. Let me just tell you what we're going to do. We have an interview that we're going to play that we had last night on Q103.3 FM out of Lakeville, Connecticut, and it tells you how to get out of debt, which is really great.
It's called the Survival Guide to Debt.
Right.
Okay.
And how to help yourself when you get into financial trouble. You know, you really can't bury your head in the sand like an ostrich, and you may feel like there's nothing that you can do, but there really is a lot that you can do to help save yourself so that you can continue on.
Yeah.
And then some things that you need to know how not to get into the situation in the first place. So that interview is very good, and we'll probably put it on in about a half hour.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the meantime, we have some news to read.
One thing that I wanted people to know, which I thought was important, I thought it was important to read this thing about the truth about flu shots, and I thought we should put that on so people can refer to it and hear it, and it's really quite frightening.
This is from Global Research, and
it was written by Dr.
Sherry Tenpenny.
Right, and it's called The Truth About Flu Shots.
I think this is a British article, actually.
Could be, but it doesn't matter.
Let me just read you something. In 1853, Parliament began passing laws to make the untested vaccine compulsory throughout the British Empire. Other countries of Europe followed suit. Once the economic implications of compulsory vaccinations were realized, few dared to disagree. Then, as now, the media were controlled by the vaccine manufacturers and the government, who stood to make huge money from the sale of these spurious vaccines. Dr. Tim O'Shea, the sanctity of human blood. Vaccination is not immunization. On June 11, 2009, the World Health Organization announced that it had declared level 6 pandemic emergency with regard to the swine flu. Shortly thereafter, on cue, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that we should expect mass vaccination in this country to begin as early as 2009. We have been covering the development of the global pandemic preparedness machine in the IO since June 1998. It is our belief that this machine has been in motion since March 28, 2009 and will not be stopped, that the global influenza pandemic the CDC and the WHO have been predicting for at least a decade will be declared, whether people are pandemically sick and dying or not, and the global mass vaccination campaign for which they have been preparing since the 1970 swine flu fiasco will commence. It is absolutely crucial that you share the following information with friends and family and both elected and appointed bureaucrats within your community. What are the ingredients of the annual flu shot? Now, that's a pretty good question. Here it is. Eggs proteins, including avian contaminant viruses such as avian leucosis, gelatin, known to cause allergic reactions and anaphylaxis, usually associated with sensitivity to eggs or gelatin proteins. Polysorbate 80, or tween 80, can cause severe allergic reactions, including anaphylaxis. Formaldehyde, which is a known carcinogen. Trititan X100, which is a strong detergent. Sucrose, which is table sugar, resin, known to cause allergic reactions, and gentamicin, an antibiotic. Thermosol, 49.6% ethyl mercury. Do flu shots help prevent the flu? Not in babies. In a review of more than 51 studies involving more than 294,000 children, it was found that there was no evidence that injecting children 6 to 24 months of age with a flu shot was any more effective than a placebo. In children over 2 years of age, it was only effective 33% of the time in preventing the flu. And not with children in asthma. In a study of 800 children with asthma, where one half were vaccinated and the other half did not receive the influenza vaccination, the two groups were compared with respect to clinic visits, emergency department visits, and hospitalizations for asthma. The conclusion: the study failed to prove the evidence that the influenza vaccine prevents pediatric asthma exacerbations. The inactivated flu vaccine, Flumist, does not prevent influenza-related hospitalizations in children, especially those with asthma. In fact, children who get the flu vaccine are at more risk for hospitalization than children who do not get the vaccine. Not in adults. In a review of 48 reports, including 66,000 adults, vaccinations of healthy adults only reduced the risk of influenza by 6% and reduced the number of missed work days by less than 1 day. It did not change the number of people needing to go to the hospital or take time off work. Not in the elderly. In a review of 64 studies, in the 98 flu season of the elderly living in nursing homes, flu shots were non-significant for preventing the flu. The elderly living in the community, vaccines were not effective against influenza. How about this? What about the new swine flu shots? Excuse me, H1N1. Excuse me, folks. A new report from WHO Advisory Group predicts the global production of vaccines for the novel H1N1 influenza virus could be as much as 4.9 billion doses a year, far higher than the previous estimates. The report states that vaccine makers are expected to produce about 780 million doses of seasonal flu vaccine for the Northern Hemisphere. 350 million doses will be ready by June 30th and 430 by July 31st. Pandemic H1N1 vaccine will be made in PRRS-C6 cells, human retinal cells, containing either ASO4 by GlaxoSmithKline or M59 by Novartis in an oil-based squalene-based adjuvant known to trigger severe autoimmunity in test animals. So it will be put out by GlaxoSmithKline or Novartis. You definitely don't want the Novartis one. I wouldn't want any. That's made in squalene-based. Federal health officials will probably recommend that most Americans get 3 full shots this fall. One regular flu shot and 2 doses of the new swine flu vaccine being rushed to market. The working hypothesis of the CDC is that most Americans will need 2 swine flu shots to get full protection. Although the elderly may be able to get away with just one. Is mandatory vaccination with the new swine flu possible? In 1946, the United States Public Health Service was established, and Executive Order 9708 was signed, listing communicable diseases that could be controlled using quarantine. Chlamydia, diphtheria, cholera, diphtheria, tuberculosis, typhoid, smallpox, yellow fever, and viral hemorrhagic fevers were added. In April 4th of 2003, SARS was added. In 2005, it was amended to include the influenza. The The power to quarantine was delegated by the President to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The Secretary of Health and Human Services was given the power to arrange for the apprehension and examinations of persons reasonably thought to be infected. On January 28, 2003, the introduction of Project BioShield during President Bush's State of the Union address, this created a permanent indefinite funding authority to develop medical countermeasures. New authority was given to the National Institute of Health to accelerate research and the development of drugs and vaccines. On December 17th of 2006, Division E Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act was added as an addendum to the Defense Appropriation Bill. The section of HHS can make the determination that disease, health conditions, or threat constitutes a public health emergency. He or she may recommend the manufacture, testing, development, administration, or use of one or more coveted countermeasures. A coveted countermeasure defined in Division E is a pandemic product, vaccine, or drug. Division E also provides complete liability protection for all drugs, vaccine, or biological products deemed to be covered countermeasure for an outbreak of any kind. Protection has been given to the drug companies for any product administered for any public health emergency declared by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Oh, so pharma is now protected from all accountability unless criminal intent to harm can be proved by the injured parties. Drug companies are protected from lawsuits, even if they know the drug will be harmful. Criminal intent would be nearly impossible to prove. What can we do to protect ourselves and our communities, we ask? Share this information with everyone you know. Contact first responders. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who wrote this, is an osteopathic physician and director of Osteomed 2 and New Medical Awareness Seminars. She is the author of Fowl, Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think and Saying No to Vaccines, a resource guide for all ages. She is a popular and well-known speaker, writer, and radio guest. So, you should go to this article, Global Research, and find out about it. It is The Truth About Flu Shots by Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. It was August 1st, 2009. I think it's worth downloading. You should look at it. I think it's really important. You want to be careful of these shots. Oh, here's the paragraph at the end. There's no proof that H1N1 virus no proof that a novel H1N1 virus actually exists. Dr. Stefan Lanka from Klein Acton is offering £10,000 to anyone who is able to produce a scientific paper proving the existence of the alleged novel H1N1 flu virus. To date, not one scientist or public health official has come forward with the proof of a novel H1N1 flu virus, and the media is generally uninterested in the fact that proof of a virus associated with a novel swine flu strain is non-existent. So how about that? So that's good.
Yeah. So next article, I'm sorry, I'm coughing here. Next article I wanted to talk about tonight was there were several here. I just wanted to double check. There's this one here, Pain Ray, first commercial sale looms. Hang on a second. All right, Pain Ray, first commercial sales loom. This is from the Danger Room. Mm. And it goes by David Hambling. And says the military isn't about to deploy its pain ray to the battlefield, but someone in the commercial sector is about to own one. We don't know who. The sale is mentioned in a presentation by Raytheon, the microwave weapon for the Defense Department. The so-called active denial system works by heating the outer surface of the target's skin using millimeter waves, short wavelength microwaves. The effect is painful but generally harmless, and forces the target to get out of the beam. Recently, it's been proposed as a possible defense against pirates. Last month, Raytheon gave a presentation on active denial at a NATO workshop on anti-pirate equipment and technologies. This presentation mentions an impending direct commercial sale of a commercial version of the active denial system known as Silent Guardian. There's a picture of it here on this page. This is active denial in a box, 10,000-pound containerized system that can be mounted on a ship, a truck, or a fixed installation. It got an effective range of about 250 meters, and the beam has a power of about 30 kilowatts. The anti-pirate presentation shows how a setup with two antennas could achieve almost 360-degree coverage for a small container ship. Imagine that, to go 250 meters in a 360-degree radius. Perhaps it would destroy anybody out there. The anti-pirate presentation shows how a set up with two antennas could achieve almost 360-degree coverage. The active denial system was first unveiled in 2001, but a series of delays have prevented it from being fielded in spite of requests for it in Iraq. Danger Room reported the wrangling in 2006 and 2008, with Defense Science Board conclusion that deployment was not politically tenable because of a possible association with torture. This could be particularly true if the weapon was used at detention centers, and a recent Government Accountability Office report indicated that the attempts to get the ADS to Iraq have now been discontinued. And paradoxically, it seems that the controversial pain beam may be more acceptable in the civilian market than in the military, depending on how the weapon is used. Certain few people would object to the active denial system being used for zapping off pirates. The long-range acoustic device, which produces an intense beam of sound, was used to fend off pirate attacking the cruise ship Seabourn Spirit in 2005, but it might be received differently if it was used in a prison or to repel intruders or protesters from company property. But we don't know who it's being sold to. And Raytheon non-lethal silent guardian system has attracted widespread interest, but it could be premature for us to discuss any sales until contracts are signed, a Raytheon spokesman told Danger Room. In the longer run, Raytheon believed that active denial might have all sorts of applications in law enforcement, prison protecting installations, not to mention chasing geese away from airports. On one day, a domestic version might even repel burglars. Of course, not everyone is enthusiastic about the prospects. For now, the high price tag could restrict potential customers, says Nilsen Davison, author of the book Non-Lethal Weapons. And Raytheon won't quote a price, but Silent Guardian is slightly to set you back several million. However, as the cost and size drop, expect police force to become more and more interested. This is where functions creep. Will become a problem, which current controversies over the misuse of the taser, the spread of new military weapon technologies to the civilian realm does not seem like a very sensible way to go. I have to agree with that.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary. We talked about this before, but, you know,
not on a ship or anything like that.
Now it's a little bit different now.
That's a scary piece of equipment.
Yeah. And,
very scary.
Yeah, just there are some other stuff here.
Do you have the interview all lined up and ready to go?
Just about, but it's only 9:20, so if you just wait a second. I'm working on it here, folks. I'm trying to find something. Well, Ahmadinejad was sworn in today.
Yep. And I heard that what I had heard is that there was still demonstration.
I'll bet there is. Mm. Can you read this?
Yeah, you got to turn it. I can't see it from here. Too far away.
Read about our man Ahmadinejad here. See what he's all up. What he's up to lately.
Yeah. Okay, folks, just give me a second. I gotta get a little closer. My vision isn't what it used to be. Ahmadinejad sworn in as Iran president after winning a hotly disputed election in Iran. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been sworn in for a second term in office as the country's president. Ahmadinejad took his oath of office before the parliament on Wednesday. He has 2 weeks to introduce his cabinet of ministers to Majlis, which is the parliament, for approval. I, as the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, swear before the Holy Quran in the Iranian nation and God to be the guardian of the official religion, the Islamic Republic, and the Constitution, Ahmadinejad said at the ceremony. More than 5,000 security and police forces gathered around the building in central Tehran. Sniffer dogs were securing the area. Head of the leader's office, Mohammadi Golpai Ghani, head of three branches of government, secretary of the Guardian Council of Ayatollah Ahmed Jamnati, and a number of foreign ambassadors in Tehran are attending the ceremony. Ahmadinejad was declared the victor of the June 12th presidential election with almost two-thirds of the vote. The president's most disputed re-election was met with opposition from other presidential candidates in an outpouring of anger demonstrated in mass rallies across the country, with protesters dubbing the poll as rigged. However, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid al-Khamenei, on Monday confirmed his support of the president, describing him as courageous, astute, and hardworking. The leader urged Ahmadinejad to heed the views of his critics. On Monday, Ayatollah Khamenei endorsed President Ahmadinejad for his second term in office in a ceremony that took place in the absence of defeated candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi, along with powerful cleric and official Ayatollah Akaba Hassimi Rafsanjani and former President Mohan Khatami.
Doing very well with those names.
There were no representatives present from the family of the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, with leading opposition figures Mousavi, Karoubi, and Khatami refusing to acknowledge Ahmadinejad's presidency. The incumbent's re-election provoked bickering in the country's political circles. At least 30 people were killed, several of whom in prison, and thousands, including prominent reformist figures and journalists, were rounded up in the course of the protests staged by the supporters of the opposition leaders, who dismissed the official election results as fraudulent and called for its annulment. U.S. President Barack Obama and the leaders of France, Britain, Italy, and Germany have all decided not to congratulate Ahmadinejad on his re-election. However, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs quoted Obama as saying, "Ahmadinejad is the elected leader." No kidding. Okay, what else did we have? Let's see.
White House wing. Let's see.
Yeah. The Obama White House may be preparing to enact new federal quarantine regulations that were put forth by the Bush administration almost 4 years ago. While the Obama administration has been tight-lipped about the possible new regulations, the Bush-era proposal sought to give the federal government the authority to order a provisional quarantine of 3 business days or up to 6 calendar days for those suspected having the swine flu or other illnesses listed in the presidential order. Let's see what else they listed. The Obama White House may be preparing to enact new federal legislation blah, blah, blah. The quarantine rules would impact airlines and cruises and require more information about domestic and international passengers be stored, but only reviewable by federal officials during a health emergency. While the Obama administration has been tight-lipped about the possible new regulations, the Bush-era proposal sought to give the federal government the authority to order a provisional quarantine of 3 business days or up to 6 calendar days for those suspected of having swine flu or other illnesses listed in a presidential executive order. When the Bush-era rules began to be leaked out, a fierce fight was planned for many on the progressive left. The opponents said they were in danger. They were a danger to civil liberties and even the Constitution itself. Politico said the White House Office of Management and Budget is targeting September to complete the first significant overhaul of the quarantine regulations in 30 years. If the date is met, it would likely be in place before the typical flu season begins in the United States. Oh, great. More to come. I don't like the sound of that at all. Okay. You almost set, Leo?
I'm all set here.
Okay. Then we should get back to... Blog Talk Radio switchboard, and be ready for your interview.
All set.
Okay. We have an interview with being interviewed is the name of the book is A Survival Guide to Debt, and Mitchell Allen is the author, and How to Overcome Tough Times, Restore Your Financial Health. And he did a really nice job. I think you'll get a lot of information.
Okay. All right. So here's the interview. It's about a half an hour long, and we hope you enjoy it. I thought it was kind of interesting. And the author, Mitchell Allen, is an interesting guy. So here we go. And this is Mitchell Allen. And A Survival Guide to Debt.
Mitchell Allen is who he is. And the name of his book is...
A Survival Guide to Debt.
A Survival Guide to Debt. And let me read a little bit about him. His personal is, he's one of 2 children. His dad was an elementary principal. His mom was a 4th grade teacher. He was born and raised in Denver City, Texas. And his birthday is December 14th, 1970. He's married with 1 son and 2 daughters. And he resides in South Lake, Texas. He has a BS in mathematics and an MS in applied mathematics. I guess he knows how to figure his money. And he likes to golf and read business magazines and books and spends time at the lake with his family. As a professional, he is founder and chairman and CEO of Debt Education and Certification Foundation, a leading bankruptcy and credit counseling nonprofit organization which has educated over 200,000 individuals since 2006. He is president of Better Bankruptcy, an online bankruptcy resource, and worked for the Associates Financial and Citigroup as a director of statistical modeling. And he's a member of EO, Entrepreneur Organization, board member of Dallas Chapter of Entrepreneurs Organization. And let's see. Knowing the warning signs of debt. Let me read a little bit to you here. Let me tell you about my friend, Doug. One morning when Doug arrived at his office, the phone on his desk was already ringing. This is from his book, Mitchell Allen's book. The tension headache he'd been nursing off and on for the most of the last 6 months ratcheted up a couple of notches as he reached for the phone. Hello, is this Doug Lewis? Doug grimaced. He knew he should have let the call go to his voicemail. Yeah, this is Doug. Mr. Lewis, this is Consolidated Collections. I'm calling about the past balance due on your loan. Doug closed his eyes, slumped in his chair. He tried to listen to the agent on the other end of the call, but the words were pretty much the same as the ones he'd been hearing several times a week for the last two or three other collectors. He thought about the stack of unopened letters on his desk at home, the ones with urgent printed in large red letters across the envelopes. He wished they were junk mail, but they weren't. Everything had been okay until Carol lost her job. Neither of them had fully realized how dependent they were on her income. But ever since, it seemed they'd been getting further and further behind. Even with the unemployment payments she'd been collecting, they just hadn't been able to adjust their lifestyle to their lower income level. Does this sound like you? Are you having these troubles? If we don't have a minimum payment of $2,000 in our office by 5 p.m. next Monday, Mr. Lewis, I'm afraid we'll have no choice but to begin repossession proceedings. Doug's attention snapped back to the call. Excuse me, how much money did you say and by when? By 5 p.m. next Monday, we need a minimum payment of $2,000 or we'll begin repossession. Doug rubbed his forehead. They might as well be asking for $1 million. The headache was starting to pound. He mumbled something and hung up the phone. He looked at his watch. It was 8:10. The week was just beginning. Maybe this story reminds you of someone. Maybe that someone is you. My guess is that if you picked up a book titled A Survival Guide to Debt, it's probably because you or someone close to you is in financial trouble. If so, keep reading. Because believe it or not, there is hope. And that's what Mitchell is going to talk to us about. So if this sounds like you out there, folks, you need to really listen closely because A Survival Guide to Debt by Mitchell Allen can help you.
Okay. Well, good evening, Mitchell. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, and how are y'all?
We're fine, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for being on.
A lot of people get into debt and get really upset, but there are people that sometimes are in debt and don't know that they're sinking. What are the signs?
Now, this is going to sound obvious, but if you start to get creditors called, you're in a lot of trouble, and you're probably in serious financial trouble. But many, many people are in trouble even before that begins, and they're doing something that I hear over and over again. As a matter of fact, it's the most common story that I hear, and that is I'm robbing Peter to pay Paul. So warning sign number one is when you're paying one debt with another one, and this includes home equity loans, then you're in serious financial trouble.
Is that a common thing that people do?
They absolutely do. They try to deal with the loan or the credit card debts on their own, which is a good thing. But then they're paying one credit card off with another one, and then they can't make payments. So they say, well, you know what? I have some equity in my home, so I'll take a home equity loan, or I'll take a loan from a 401k or other retirement account, which specifically for a home equity loan, I think is one of the worst things that someone can do because you're exchanging a credit card debt, which is an unsecured debt, for a secured one, which is your home. So if you don't make those payments, then the lenders can come and take away your home.
And that's far more serious than a credit card debt, obviously.
Yes, it absolutely is more serious. Though when you're in the situation, credit card companies, they're very aggressive. They'll call far more than, say, your mortgage lender will. And so you feel lots of pressure to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to restrain yourself, you've got to take a deep breath, and communicate openly with your creditors, and don't make one of those big mistakes, and that is getting a home equity loan just to pay off your credit card bill. You need professional help considering that.
Well, one question that I have is if you're in foreclosure, all right, let's say you took out a small equity loan of $50,000. Okay, your house was worth $350. Okay, it's now worth you took out, you know, so you owe $250 on it. All right, your first mortgage is $200,000, which you got behind on your second mortgage, which is $50. All right, chances are okay, but you bought your car with that $50. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, but chances are, all right, you're not going to be able to, no bank is good. The bank is not going to foreclose on a $50,000 note if it's taken a second place to a $200,000 first. All right, what kind of position are you in there, and how can you negotiate your way out of a, or
well,
maybe
it's an excellent question, and we see this quite often. If you don't make those payments, it is secured by the home, though they are secondary to the primary lien holder. But in today's market, it's really shocking how lenders will bend over backwards for you. Matter of fact, Freddie Mac did a survey and said more than 6 in 10 homeowners that are delinquent on their mortgage payments, they're not aware of the services that the mortgage lenders can offer individuals having trouble on their mortgage. So there are tremendous programs out there that the lenders have, and they will bend over backwards because they don't want to take your home back.
Mm-hmm. They could rewrite those notes. They could lower the payments. They could do something. They can work something out.
That's right. There's temporary, like a forbearance, which is reducing or eliminating payments for a time, a reinstatement, where you make a lump payment in the future to catch
right.
up.
Right.
They can even create a repayment plan, which will work alongside your regular payments, or even go as far as loan modification, which is rewriting the loan and changing the terms, such as extending the term or even reducing the interest rate.
Right.
Do you think that it's ignorance that is the reason that people don't try to work things out, or do you think that people are unwilling to face the fact that they're in trouble? Or
they're just afraid to notify the bank.
Yeah, I think those are excellent points, and it is. I think that you get these stack of bills, and you're almost paralyzed
mm-hmm.
by not knowing what to do or not thinking that there is that anybody's going to help you. But in the book, The Survival Guide to Debt, I continue to say the number one thing you need to do is communicate.
Mm-hmm.
If you will contact the creditor, whether it be for your home, for your car, or a credit card, acknowledge that you have the debt and tell them that you cannot pay at this time and be very specific about why you can't do it, whether it be a loss of job or divorce or a medical issue. And then work with them. Ask them specifically what programs they have and what they can do for people in your situation. Ask if they have a hardship program. Document the conversations that you have, and then follow through with what you say you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get a hold of you. They don't want your car. They don't want your house. They don't want to keep making these calls. They want to work something out with you. So communicate with them because they do want to help you.
Now, would that be the person who calls you to collect, or do you ask for someone higher up, or is there a special unit in these credit card companies that deal with these problems?
Depending on how far in the process you are,
mm-hmm.
you can talk with just a customer service rep and ask for somebody in a hardship program, or they even have what's called a 60-60 plan, which is paying back 60% of what you owe over 60 months. Just ask. Whoever you're talking with, be the collections department within the credit card company, or if your debt has already been sold to a collection agency, ask them about it because they're getting paid by the credit card companies on what they collect. So whoever you're talking with, just ask them. But make sure you document what you say to them and follow through.
Okay. That's good advice.
That works, I guess. But let's say you get a home that's, you bought your house at $300, it's now worth $200. You borrowed an FHA with a 5% down and you're sitting there with a house that you owe more than it's worth. What do you do then?
In this situation, I first would say, are you currently making your payments? If you're making your payments, even though the house is on paper worth less than what you paid for it, continue making your payments. Many people are perfectly happy within the house that they're living, even though technically they're upside down on it. And that should not be... people shouldn't freak out about that, because when you buy a car, a brand new car, when you drive it off the lot, you're instantly upside down. You owe more than what you paid for it. Houses, we just haven't been in that situation as long as we can remember. But if you're able to make your house payments, just continue to make those house payments. There's been some talk in the government and by Congress about trying to fix some of this people being upside down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's going to go anywhere. That's just a personal opinion. But as long as you're current, just keep making those payments. But with the adjustable rate mortgage and a slower real estate market, that really can translate into falling prices and home values.
Now, look, I think, because I used to do this for a living, and so I used to deal with banks and brokers as a broker, I would see sacrifices to the extent of 50%. in some instances to 25%, 30% was common, 50%, sometimes up to 75% of value of the mortgage people those banks would take, okay, just to get out from under that nut, all right? They would do it. Okay, if you can find a lender who will give you the money, or go to them and say, look, the house is worth nothing here, you know, I'm dying and I need, can you restructure my mortgage or work something out? And 9 out of 10 times, they might do it. And in hard times like right now, if you go in and you offer them 50 cents on the dollar, all right, they might consider that. Okay, since they're looking at never getting paid, you know, or getting paid far less. All right, if they have to foreclose on it.
Yeah, you know what? I totally agree with that, and that goes back to communication.
Yeah, I mean, Bill, back in the 80s and 90s, I used to represent builders. We'd go back and we'd buy the same. They'd owe $3 million on a development. We'd go back with some cash and offer $1.5 million. All right, to rewrite their note at $1.5 million, buy the bank out, give the bank $1.5 million. They're happy campers, and they're out, and they just took a bath for $1.5 million, you know.
Right.
So, but man, I've seen it in action. All right, under the art, in the last bank failure back in the 80s and 90s, yeah, it's just like, man, I mean, the banks were taking anything they could get. You know, and a lot of banks were just folding their, they went into resolution trust, the banks went under, and the government started collecting the stuff, you know.
Yeah,
trying to sell it off, pennies on the dollar. You know?
Yeah, when banks foreclose on a house, they are going to lose money, somewhere between 20 to 60 cents on the dollar. They lose money every time that they foreclose on a house. So if you'll communicate with them, they will work with you specifically in the times that we're in right now, because banks are hurting themselves.
But the question I have for you too is, now, if can a bank actually rewrite its note now that they've sold them into these derivatives and everything, all these things, their mortgages are all chopped up under these and divided under these what do they call them? Mortgage-backed securities that have been sold in the on the secondary markets. All right. One of the biggest problems that we face, and the reason for so many foreclosures and so many of these problems that arrive in the TARP funding, the emergency TARP bill, is because they couldn't negotiate, and nobody even knew who owned the damn things. Okay, the banks didn't even own them, or the mortgage companies that sold them, or the banks that sold these notes sold them out. Nobody knew who owned them because they were all subdivided and chopped up and put into different mortgage-backed securities, and through Goldman Sachs and I believe Morgan Stanley was doing it. All of these people. So this was what caused the bank failures to begin with in the last few years. And so what I'm saying is, can you go to the bank now? You could back to 10, 20 years ago, but now can you go to these banks and they say, okay, I want to rewrite this note. And they say, well, we don't have it. We can't rewrite it. We can't do anything for you. What is your option there?
Hey, you do have to find out who is your lender. And
because whoever you lent the money, you borrowed the money from, that doesn't necessarily have it.
Yeah, okay, they most of the time have gone and resold those things.
Right, and they're not servicing the money.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it is very difficult. Just to get a little bit about sort of on a personal side of that, with adjustable rate mortgages, the banks were clearly lending to individuals that were not capable of making payments, and they were banking on these incredible increases in property value.
Right, right.
I really think in part of what in the book Survival Guide we talk about is taking personal responsibility for your own actions, really understanding what the amount of income that you bring in and the expenses that you can afford to pay going forward, particularly for housing, because that is one of the largest, if not the largest, expense that people have.
Do you think that those problems were caused by the sense of entitlement we have as Americans, that we expect to own our own homes?
Yeah, I actually think that...
Do you think it's our own fault?
I actually think that the American dream isn't to own your home. It's to own it free and clear, to own a car without a note. So I think that there is a sense of entitlement about, yeah, I want to go out and buy a huge house. I want to buy a nice car. But you're not really owning those things until you've paid them off. And with the amount of money that has been taken out of the home equity that people have over the last few years, it's not surprising that we're in the situation that we're in with so many people being upside down, so many people not being able to pay their bills. I just saw a CNN report today that said bankruptcies were up last month were up 36%. 36% from last year, and it's about that same amount year to date, up about 36% from the year before, over 1.2 million people filing bankruptcy. So it is still a huge problem going on with people not being able to meet their commitments.
How do you know when you should throw in the towel and file bankruptcy? I mean, when do you know you should do that?
I don't think bankruptcy is the first thing you should try.
Okay.
But really, five things you should do. One, try to do it yourself. Make more, spend less. I say play better offense and play better defense.
Mm-hmm.
Two, see if you can take a loan from family, friends, maybe a bank. I've already said I don't think people should do a home equity loan. Then try, there are lots of nonprofits out there that do credit counseling that will work with your credit card companies to lower interest rates and help you repay your debts over a period of five years. There are companies that do debt settlement, and there's lots of controversy about whether or not that's something that you should be doing, and lots of attorney generals are investigating debt settlement companies across the country, so you need to be very careful about that. But once you've looked into those options, and those options, you've either tried them or they're not appropriate for you, you should talk to a bankruptcy attorney and see if you can get the fresh start that the bankruptcy code provides.
Now, what exactly is a debt settlement company?
A debt settlement company works this way. Generally, they'll tell you stop paying your credit card payments and send that money to them. They will then put that money into a trust account for you, and you'll send them that money for many months, and they'll take some amount of money out for processing fees and the fees that they charge. They will then call the credit card companies some number of months down the road and say, listen, here is John. He hasn't made a payment in however many months. He owes you $10,000, but he will give you $5,000 today if you will consider his account paid in full. And because they think that they're not going to get any money, the credit card companies will say, wow, that sounds like a pretty good deal. I'm going to get 50 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar of what I'm owed, so I'll accept it. And so they've just negotiated a settlement with your credit card company.
Now, would you be able to do that yourself?
You are able to do that yourself, and I've actually, many, many years ago, I've actually helped several people do that on their own, where they had some money from family or friends to be able to pay off a large credit card debt in one lump sum. You can absolutely call them, work out your own settlement with these credit card companies. You do not have to have somebody else. And matter of fact, they're very expensive. They can charge sometimes a percentage of what they save you, up to 25% of what they save you. So it can be very, very expensive.
Okay, so you're going to try some kind of debt settlement or borrow money from a friend or family. But what if you can't do that? Should you file bankruptcy then?
And I say this in a survival guide to debt, that I'm not an attorney, and anytime you consider a legal matter, you should definitely seek legal advice. Talk to a bankruptcy attorney and see what type of bankruptcy is right for you. There are generally two types of bankruptcy that consumers typically file: a Chapter 7, which is a straight bankruptcy, which just discharges your unsecured debt, and a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which is a reorganization of your debt, which allows you to repay some portion of your debts over a period of up to 5 years.
So in Chapter 7, you say it discharges your debt. Does that mean that all the money you owe, you don't owe from now on?
Once your debt has been discharged, you don't owe it anymore. A Chapter 7 will only discharge, though, debts that are dischargeable, such as credit card debts.
Mm-hmm.
One of the misconceptions about bankruptcy that people come and talk to us about, they think, wow, I'm going to file bankruptcy and I'm going to get to keep my house without paying for it. You know, that's just silly. The things you want to keep, you're going to have to pay for. If you want to keep your car, you've got to continue making those car payments. If you want to keep your house, you've got to continue making those house payments. But at Chapter 7, if you file Chapter 7, you can discharge your credit card debt, your unsecured debt.
But not your secured debt.
That's correct.
So any debt that...
Generally speaking, if you want to keep something, you've got to pay for it.
Okay. So what about your student loans?
Student loans are a little bit different. Under most circumstances, they are not dischargeable. And I've talked with hundreds of attorneys across the country. And there are very specific hardship circumstances where you can discharge student loan debt, but I have yet to talk to an attorney who has actually done it. So child support, student loans, tax debt, those are maybe some tax debt and student loans are maybe specific situations where you can discharge it. Those are types of debts called priority debts that are typically very difficult to deal with, even in bankruptcy.
So if you owe federal income taxes or state taxes, you got to pay them?
Well, again, you need to talk with an attorney or your tax advisor regarding this. There are ways within bankruptcy to discharge some of your taxes. There are also some methods that the IRS has. You can do an offering compromise. And, again, speak with an attorney if you have tax issues because there are very specific rules regarding those.
Now, as far as student loans go, how could you, can you ever get any relief under those things? I mean, can you negotiate if you owe $100,000?
I think Obama passed some new things passed on student loans, I think, recently. I don't remember.
Okay, I'll speak from personal experience on this. I've had student loans, and luckily I'm glad to say that I paid them off, but many, many thousands of dollars in student loans. And there are tremendous ways to deal with these things. You can defer your payments. You can spread them out over time, consolidate them to very, very low interest rates. So there are plans that you can deal with those, and most people who have student loans take advantage of those. But ultimately, you're going to have to pay them, pay those student loans back.
Well, usually, I mean, you can usually defer it. Like, you usually defer it until you graduate. You know, until
after. Absolutely, and even after that, I deferred
6 years or
personally. I deferred my loans. Mm-hmm. I think 5 years after after I graduated,
right.
And once I consolidated, the interest rate was really, really palatable.
Oh, I see that works, but you know, but you can't discharge these things. I mean, you can't if you're in bankruptcy. You can't get rid of them.
Generally speaking, you can't. And as I said, I've spoken with hundreds of attorneys, and not a single one of them has discharged them through bankruptcy.
Well, how did they discharge them?
Other things, they have not.
They haven't.
I've read that you can. I've yet to talk to an attorney who has.
But, you know, it's just amazing to me how a guy can go through, you know, how you have to go through $100,000 or $200,000 worth of tuition, you know, borrow it from somewhere. Get out and owe $150,000 to $200,000 before you even start work.
Especially doctors, it's very hard.
Oh yeah, God, yeah.
They have to borrow a lot of money.
Lawyers and so on. I mean, but nevertheless, wouldn't they be in a position like that they could possibly? I mean, they just have to negotiate the debt down, and can they negotiate it down, or they just have to pay it? And that's it.
They just really have to pay it.
So we've talked a lot about the problems that people get into, but how can people prevent themselves from having these problems? Do you have any advice for people so that they don't get into debt?
And what could they take away also? If you don't pay your student loan, what can they take away from you, your education? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like,
Well, you know, with credit, all things that when you're borrowing money, and dealing with finances, they affect your credit.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very concerned about their credit. Most of the time when people come in to talk about considering bankruptcy or credit counseling, they're thinking, well, if I file bankruptcy or do credit counseling, I'm never going to be able to get a credit card again or buy a home or buy a car. And that's generally not true. Credit only affects how much you're going to pay for those things. Someone is generally always going to be able, will always be willing to lend you money.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the rate at which they'll lend it to you. If you have very good credit, you might get a house at 4.5% or 5%. If you have average credit, as you know, maybe 6, 7, 8%. If you have poor credit, it could be over 10%.
Mm-hmm.
In the book is actually, The Survival Guide to Debt is broken into three sections. And the third section actually talks about the blocking and tackling and digging ditches of personal finance. And the most important thing is to prepare a budget and match your expenses to your income. And most people do not do this. They don't reconcile their bank statement, look at their credit card statements to make sure they understand what their money is going for. And that's the first thing that we sit down with everyone is do is prepare a budget and say this is how much money I'm bringing in from all the jobs that I'm working and all the sources of income I have. And this is where the money is going. This is how much I'm spending for my home, my auto, my gas, insurance, food, entertainment, and listing all these things out and seeing where we can cut where is necessary. So the first thing you need to do is create a budget and really see where your money is going.
Mm-hmm. And do you think people should, do you think it's a good idea to use some of the models they have on for computer programs? Do you think those work for people?
Use whatever works for you. I know people who use who really just use their checkbook,
mm-hmm.
people who use a written form, and if you go to a survivalguidetodebt.com, you can actually get forms, free forms to download that will work. You can go on to, I think, money.com, as well as several other websites. Any of them will work. You just have to use them. And that's what people don't do. They just don't use them. They think, wow, this is math. This is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
This is talking about goal setting. And they turn off.
Do you think it's a real failure in our education system that we don't really teach this to our young people?
Yes, it is absolutely a tragedy. Our nonprofit, we've educated over 215,000 people over the last 4 years
mm-hmm.
without regard to their ability to pay. And that's the number one thing they say after they get finished with the course is, I wish that I would have had this information when I was in high school
mm-hmm.
or whenever I had just graduated and getting out of my own, that we do not teach this in our in the public school system. And it's coming back to bite us. So we must change that. We must educate our children about finances, getting them involved in a household budget, and talking to about money with them.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important. And it's so practical, and every single one of us should be able to use your system or someone's system and certainly read your book. I mean, it's a great book. And
when I went to high school, I used to have a they had a business, and they had a business section, which was accounting. You learned accounting, and you learned other things and typing. And
but they didn't talk about your personal finances.
Everything. But they never talked about how to balance a checkbook or how to even write a check.
And let's face it.
And things. And then and it's the same way today. I mean, I don't know of any school that's teaching.
Well, there might be some schools that are.
Or electives, but they should be mandatory for basic fundamental understanding
of
our economic system. And nobody knows. You get up and you don't understand the banking system. You don't understand the finances. You don't understand anything.
Well, these are life skills that are really important. So do you do a lot of teaching?
Besides educating within the nonprofit, as I said, we educate 15 or 17,000 people a month.
Wow.
In terms of financial education and debtor education associated with our nonprofit. And so, yes, we that's primarily what my passion is, about educating people
mm-hmm.
about personal finances. One of the things also I really stress is that you are not your debt, and that we need to separate our self-worth from our net worth. People come in and they feel like the weight of the world is on them. The debt and creditor calls are affecting their spouse, how they relate to their spouse and their children, how productive they are at work. And once they have a solution, they feel like the world has been lifted, the weight of the world has been lifted from them. So we need to really disassociate that people are not their debt, and you don't need to determine how good you feel about yourself about how many people are calling you about your collections calls.
Now, if our listeners would like to purchase your book, what do they do?
You can go to Amazon.com and just search for A Survival Guide to Debt, or you can go to asurvivalguidetodebt.com, and you can purchase it either through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or directly through the website.
Survival Guide to Debt.
Okay, and your site is
it's asurvivalguidetodebt.com.
asurvivalguidetodebt.com. Excellent book, and filled with good advice for people, and of course.
And it's reasonable price.
Yeah,
right, but it's
very good.
$14.95.
I think that's a very good price for a book like this, with all kinds of information and help. And I guess the first thing you have to do is face the position you're in, and when you do, this is a real tool for getting out of the problem that you're in.
So
thanks for writing such a good book to help all of us, Mitchell. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right. And you know, and as far as, again, A Survival Guide to Debt.com, and the book's name is...
Okay, the book's name is Survival Guide to Debt, Mitchell Allen. And I want to say good night, next 10 seconds we have here. And please join me tomorrow night when I read more of Manly Hall, and Friday night when we talk with George Dixon. So good evening, and thanks for joining us. Good night.